Tell me more about you and Scott, Avery commanded, just to hear someone talk. Risha dutifully recounted the latest development in her on-again, off-again romance with Scott Bandier, who was a senior at Berkeley. Avery forced herself to laugh so that no one would notice her strange mood. If she laughed and smiled and nodded enough, nothing would really be wrong. But inside, her mind was roiling erratically, fluttering from one topic to the next without any resolution. She couldn't focus on anything, couldn't think, just kept picking at the cold remains of the miso souffle. The kaleidoscope of light and sound washed over her, dulling the persistent ache in her heart. She kept taking sips of her martini, which Ming must have refilled at some point, though she hadn't noticed. Eventually, their group began to swell. First, it was a couple of other girls from their class, Anandra and Danica. They'd seen the snaps and wanted to join. And then more Berkeley kids showed up, clustering around the bar, ordering that signature purple martini and posting snaps to the feeds, bringing even more people. Soon Avery felt like half the Berkeley student body was there, spilling onto the dark wooden dance floor in sticky clumps. She thought she saw Lita at one point, but before she could be sure, a trio of guys, Rick, Maxton, Zay Wagner, bore down on their table.
"Zay dumped Daniela, you know," Ming whispered with a meddlesome wink.
Avery didn't react to that news at first. He'd been sitting in the same place all night, a little like a queen presiding over her subjects. Not that she'd meant it that way. She just hadn't cared enough about anything to bother moving. But Ming had a point. Why shouldn't she talk to Zay? What was left to hold her back? She didn't have Atlas anymore, no matter what she did. Avery suddenly remembered how, whenever Eris felt heartbroken after a relationship, she would throw herself violently and wholeheartedly into a flirtation with someone new. Avery had asked her about it once. "There's no forgetting like that kind of forgetting," Eris had replied, with an arch smile and a knowing flash of her eyes.
"Zay!"
Avery exclaimed after a beat, standing up slowly, the way Eris would have.
"How have you been?"
Zay seemed startled by her attention. After all, she had soundly rejected him several months earlier.
"Great. Thanks," he said cautiously.
But Avery was determined not to be ignored. She turned her flirtation on full wattage, flashing her brightest smile. Poor Zay didn't stand a chance. She was just about to lead him onto the dimly lit dance floor when someone tapped at Zay's elbow.
"Mind if I cut in?"
Cord took Avery's arm and smoothly led her away. Zay stood there about to protest, his mouth half open like a gutted fish. "That line was a bit cliched, even for you," Avery accused, though she didn't really mind. She hadn't actually cared about Zay. She had just felt strangely loose and unmoored, and needed to do something, anything, to feel anchored. And if Atlas saw her on the feeds, bright and glittering and careless, that wouldn't have bothered her either.
"Here I thought you were going to thank me for the rescue."
"Zay isn't that bad," Avery protested unconvincingly. Cord laughed.
"I wasn't talking about you. I was rescuing Zay from another broken heart." "You're a little cruel sometimes, you know, Avery," he said lightly.
Avery glanced up at him. They hadn't spoken since the party the weekend before. "I didn't know you were coming out tonight."
"I wasn't, until I saw all the snaps."
"Cord," she said, not quite certain what she wanted to tell him. That he shouldn't read anything into that moment on his couch, that she was raw and hurting, and that he should stay away from her. But before she could formulate a coherent thought, she let out a hiccup. Cord laughed. Avery had always loved the way Cord laughed, really laughed, not his cynical, dark laugh, but the genuine one. He laughed with his whole body, the way he used to when they were kids. Before she'd quite realized it, they were dancing, his hands at her waist.
"You're still not going to tell me what's going on, are you?" he said at last.
"I'm fine,"
Avery gave her head an emphatic shake.
Look, I don't know who this guy is, but if you really want to make him jealous, you need to do better than Wagner.
How do you know it's a guy? She asked quickly, wondering what had given her away.
Cord gave a triumphant grin.
I didn't until just now. Thank you for confirming my suspicions.
Now it was Avery's turn to laugh. It made her feel surprisingly good. Almost normal again for a fleeting second, if there could be such a thing as normal in a world without Atlas.
Come on. You'll have to get closer to really sell it, Cord told her, his voice husky.
Avery hesitated before stepping in to loop her arms around Cord's shoulders. He really was very tall. A terrible, sinful part of her hoped that someone was snapping it and uploading it to the feeds. It would serve Atlas right. But then she thought of Atlas actually looking at the snap, wondered what he would think of her for going straight to Cord again, and her arms fell back down. Cord didn't miss a beat, just began twirling her in an easy, friendly way.
Besides, he added, I've been your friend since we were in preschool. I know you wouldn't command our whole class out on a weeknight without good reason.
I didn't command them, they just showed up. Avery protested, realizing a beat later that he'd used the word friend. A sense of relief flooded through her. They swayed back and forth for a while, the electric lights above them flashing drunkenly from one color to another. Avery felt suddenly exhausted. Too much had happened lately. Her world falling apart, all the tears she'd shed, the knowledge that Atlas really was leaving, going halfway across the world. She closed her eyes and allowed herself the luxury of resting her head on Cord's chest.
Thank you, Cord, for all of it, she murmured, knowing he would understand.
He didn't say anything, but she felt him nod.
And so it begins, Avery thought, as if she were squaring her shoulders to pick up an impossibly heavy load. She needed to start putting herself back together, piece by piece. Because this was the start of her life without Atlas in it.
Watt. Wake up, Watt. Nadia whispered into his ear as their hydrogen-fueled jet began its descent. Watt stirred and rubbed his eyes, a little annoyed with himself for falling asleep on this flight. It was his first time on a plane, first time leaving New York, really, unless you counted the one time his science class went to the Space Museum in Washington before the latest round of budget cuts eliminated things like out-of-state field trips. Watt glanced out the window on his left and gave an involuntary intake of breath. He was looking out over Nevada, which stretched stark and pigmentless all the way to the horizon. It was like seeing the surface of some desert planet. How surreal to think that normally he was that far down, chained to the Earth's surface by the restraints of gravity. Next to him, Lita crossed one skinny leg over the other and closed her eyes, glossy and cool and indifferent.
Nadia, what should I say to break the ice?
I don't know, Watt. I haven't found much precedent for a couple that's blackmailing each other, hooked up, and are now headed to a rehab check-in, Nadia replied. I did find one on a Hollow show, but removed it from the data set as unrealistic. Watt ignored the sarcasm, though Nadia's conclusions weren't far off his own. He had no idea what to make of the situation with Lita. That night with her had been dark and bitter and reckless and, honestly, the most electric hookup of his life. He hadn't expected to hear from Lita after that, or at least hadn't expected anything but more surveillance requests. He'd been shocked when she messaged him demanding that he come to Nevada with her, for some meeting with her old rehab counselor. She'd offered no further explanation than a link to his airline ticket.
There's no way she'll ever trust me enough to confess the truth about Eris. Is there?
Watt asked Nadia, not really expecting an answer.
I'd say you're not off to a great start, given that you both said you can't stand each other, Nadia pointed out dryly.
When he remembered the exchange that Nadia was talking about, how they'd been half-dressed in Lita's bed, Watt felt suddenly uncomfortable,
thought I told you to always shut off when I'm in, intimate situations, he reminded her. He'd made that command a long time ago. There was something he couldn't handle about having a third presence in the bed, even if it was just a computer. Yes, but you also directly commanded that I never turn off when Lita is around, Nadia reminded him. Please reinstate the block on romantic situations, he thought firmly. We should revisit your definition of romantic, because whatever is going on right now, I don't think it qualifies. You know what I mean, he thought, and stretched out a little farther in his plush first-class seat. Honestly, Nadia, I'm losing track of all the commands I've given you. I'm happy to make you a list with timestamps. Snarky as usual. Watt knew he just had to get through the weekend and get on with his life, and try to have some fun pushing Lita's buttons in the process. It was the best outcome he could hope for at this point. The plane touched down with a thud, steam rising from the hydrogen fuel system like liquid smoke, a few droplets scattering onto the scorched runway below. Watt remembered that once upon a time planes had been powered with carbon-based fuels, not water. How short-sighted and wasteful. He and Lita still didn't speak as they made their way into the waiting area, where floating hoverbots brought over their luggage. Lita tilted her head for a moment, receiving an incoming message. Our car is here, she said shortly, and headed into the glaring outdoors. She moved like a ballet dancer, her carriage erect, her shoulders back, her steps light and quick as if the ground were on fire and she couldn't bear to touch it for any length of time. Something unfamiliar danced along the periphery of Watt's vision. It took him a moment to realize that it was his shadow. The solar lighting in the tower was perfectly even from all angles. Unlike the real sun, a single, focused source of light that actually moved throughout the day. So he never saw his shadow within the tower itself. He suppressed the urge to stop and study it. He and Lita maintained their chilly silence as they slid into a car, its polymer exterior set to a bright silver blue, and turned onto the speedway. The dusty horizon line glimmered in the distance. Watt closed his eyes and played mental chess with Nadia. She felt such pity for him that she let him win, for once. Suddenly, they were turning down a side road into a lush profusion of green. A village of sandstone buildings was centered on an enormous pool, with a waterfall that flowed upward. A cleverly constructed illusion, Watt realized. Flowers cascaded over the red tile roofs, and palm trees stretched their fronds up into the sky. Girls walked throughout the space. Like Lita, they all had an aura of wealth and privilege, yet a hollow, haunted look about their eyes. Next to him, Watt felt Lita tensing up. No wonder she didn't want to come here, he thought. Despite looking like a high-end spa, it probably brought back some memories that were complete shit. He didn't speak until they'd arrived at their rooms, each a self-contained cottage on wooden stilts, in a far corner near the pool. Separate rooms? I thought I was supposed to be your boyfriend, he said, raising an eyebrow. What little composure Lita had left seemed to snap at his remark. She unlocked Watt's door and grabbed his shirt by the collar, pulling him roughly inside. She was suddenly very close, so close that he could feel her pulse leaping through her wrist. There was a microscopic fleck of green in one of her dark eyes. Watt had never noticed it before. He found himself staring at it, wondering which of her parents it had come from. "Let's get this straight. You are here for one thing only," Lita told him. "To get my mom off my back by helping me pass this stupid rehab check-in, preferably with as little actual rehab as possible. I only told them you're my boyfriend so that you could be here as my accountability partner instead of my mom." Watt wondered why Lita was so against bringing her mom here, but decided it was too complicated a question. He'd rather keep rattling her composure.
"You're sure this isn't a cross-country booty call?"
"What happened last weekend was a drunken mistake that we will never repeat and never speak of. You are working this weekend, got it? This is not your damn vacation." Lita's voice crackled with tension.
Watt smiled. "Of course this is my vacation.
It's not every day that I'm coerced into flying to Nevada.
Nadia directed his attention to a schedule projected on the cottage wall.
She loves yoga, Nadia reminded him, probably attempting to be helpful. But Watt knew exactly how Lita would react if he hijacked her beloved yoga class.
Now, if you'll excuse me, I'd like to make afternoon yoga, he said, with a nod at the schedule.
No, you are not coming to yoga with me, Lita threatened. But the more she protested, the more Watt was determined to be there. The fun was just beginning.
Later, after an hour of yoga in the meditation teepee, which Watt had mostly spent sitting cross-legged, watching Lita flow effortlessly through the poses despite Watt's attempts to make distracting noises, they were both in the waiting room of the main building. Watt crossed an ankle over the opposite knee and jangled his foot impatiently. Lita kept shooting him glances, clearly piqued, so of course he didn't stop.
I'll do all the talking, she volunteered at last. You don't have to say anything. Just smile and nod and answer any direct questions as quickly as possible. All you have to remember is that you're my supportive, helpful boyfriend. Oh, and that your older sister died tragically of addiction, she added, almost as an afterthought. Watt pretended to gasp in horror.
You invented a big sister for me and then killed her? How could you?
Lita rolled her eyes. Don't make me regret bringing you here, Watt.
Don't worry. I already regretted enough for the both of us, he replied cheerfully, just as the door opened to reveal a slender, red-haired woman in a doctor's coat.
Lita, nice to see you again.
The doctor held out a hand. She wasn't wearing a name tag, but it didn't slow Watt down because he already knew everything about her. Game time, Nadia, he thought, and stepped forward.
Dr. Reasoner, Watt Bakrati. I'm Lita's boyfriend.
He gave a charming smile and shook her hand as they all sat down.
Watt's here as my accountability partner, Lita hurried to explain.
Dr. Reasoner's brow furrowed.
Lita, I don't have any mention of a boyfriend in your file.
We only started dating this fall, after Lita came back.
Watt reached out to put a hand on Lita's, where it sat on the arm of her chair, and laced his fingers in hers. She shot him a dark look. Dr. Reasoner leaned forward, regarding them both curiously.
And how did you two meet?
Watt was actually interested in a friend of mine first, but once he met me, he realized that we were much more similar, Lita said tersely.
She dug her fingernails into his palm. He turned his grimace into a smile.
Yes, I regret to say that, like Lita, I'm entirely self-absorbed and insecure. It's something I'm working on.
Watt declared so matter-of-factly that Dr. Reasoner blinked, unsure how to react. He could feel Lita seething next to him, her anger radiating in small, swirling waves.
And Watt, you understand what it means to be an accountability partner?
The doctor said after a moment, clearly deciding to ignore that last comment.
That your job is to enable Lita to keep making good choices?
Of course I understand, Dr. Reasoner, he said quietly. Although Lita is really the one who helped me. I can't tell you what an inspiration she was to my sister. You see, my sister suffered from crippling addictions for years.
Yes, poor Nadia, Lita said meaningfully, but Watt ignored the veiled threat.
She was addicted to Zenperhydrin, alcohol, attention, you name it. Lita was an incredible role model for her because, of course, Lita has been addicted to all those things at some point.
And how is your sister now?
Dr. Reasoner asked, her face lined with well-bred concern.
Oh, she died, Watt said flippantly, and shot Lita a satisfied look, as if she should be proud of him for remembering.
She looked like she wanted to strangle him with her bare hands.
I'm so sorry to hear that.
I wish we could have treated her here.
The doctor managed, clearly taken aback. She cleared her throat uncomfortably and turned to Lita.
Lita, have you felt any addictive tendencies in the last few months?
No,
Lita said quickly.
Not for drugs or alcohol, at any rate,
Watt interrupted with an exaggerated wink.
Well, I'd like to go over our recommended follow-up for treatment.
The doctor faltered, her eyes rapidly dilating and contracting as she looked at two different versions of something.
I guess we'll use the partner's plan instead of the parent. Though, Lita, I still think your mom will want to see.
Of course we should use the partner's plan. I'm not going anywhere,
Watt promised, watching in unabashed delight as Lita gritted her teeth and nodded. Later that night, Watt lay in the oversized king bed in his Mexican-inspired casita, a superfluity of pillows piled around him like whipped frosting. He was, honestly, confused to be in bed alone. Not that he really wanted to hook up with Lita, he told himself. But why didn't she want to hook up with him? He'd been so sure that they would end up together tonight. After that hilarious farce of a check-in, which Lita had accused him of sabotaging,
"Are you kidding? I saved it," he'd boasted.
They had declined the optional but clearly encouraged share circle and eaten dinner in the cafeteria. Then they had gone to Watt's room to watch a silly kids' hollow about a cartoon donkey. They'd been sitting on the couch, not the bed, with plenty of distance between them. Yet they'd been laughing with such ease that, for once, Lita had seemed genuinely relaxed. He'd been shocked when the hollow ended and Lita said goodnight, then stood up and just walked out the door. Now here he was, alone in the most luxurious bedroom he'd ever set foot in, utterly bewildered.
Nadia, what do you think Lita really wanted, bringing me all the way here? He mused aloud.
I would have called this a statistical anomaly, except there are no statistics, Nadia replied.
I'm glad, at least, that you seemed to have fun.
She said that last bit a little huffily, as if this weren't an appropriate time for fun. A blood-curdling scream sounded through the wall from Lita's room.
Nadia, is she okay?
Watt cried out, sliding out of bed and stumbling forward. There isn't a feed in her room, Nadia replied, but Watt had already run barefoot onto Lita's front step and started pounding at the door. An instant later, the bolt slid open as Nadia infiltrated the rehab center's system and granted Watt access. Lita was twisted in a knot of sheets, her eyes closed, her mouth contorted in a grimace. She was screaming, a primal, otherworldly cry that made Watt want to cover his ears and back away. Instead, he hurried forward to grab Lita's hands, which were clawing frantically at the covers.
Lita, it's okay, you're safe, I'm here, he kept saying, rubbing his thumbs over the backs of her wrists.
Eventually, the screams became moans and died down, and then Lita grew still. Her eyes fluttered slowly, her lashes thick and damp against her cheeks.
What?
She asked drowsily, as if she didn't understand why he was there. Watt wasn't sure either. He quickly let go of her hands.
You were screaming, he said helplessly. It sounded terrible, like you were being tortured. I wanted to make sure you were okay.
Yeah, right. You would rejoice if I was tortured, Lita croaked. She sat up and tucked her hair behind her ears with a quick gesture. Watt saw that she was wearing a white silk nightgown. It would have been almost girlish, except that it clung so suggestively to the contours of her body. He averted his eyes.
Normally, yeah, but I need to make that flight home tomorrow, and I'm not sure I can return without you.
Watt realized he was babbling. There was a strange pressure on his chest. He took another step back.
Sorry, I'll let you get some sleep.
Please don't go,
Lita said quickly, her eyes wide. She swallowed. The nightmares. Please, just stay until I fall asleep. In that moment, she didn't look anything like Watt's enemy, like the bitter, hard-edged girl who had threatened and coerced him.
the girl in this bed was a stranger, who looked young and lost and achingly lonely. Watt started to pull up a chair next to the bed, then hesitated. Sitting in a chair next to Lita's bed felt somehow strange, as if she were sick in a hospital, which, he realized, might have been how she'd ended up in this place to begin with. His eyes met Lita's, and she inclined her head ever so slightly in understanding, wordlessly shifting to create space for him. Lita was very still and very small as Watt slid into the bed and curled around her. He listened to the ragged rise and fall of her breath. There was an excited nervousness spiking up and down her body, and Watt knew that he was the cause of it, and he realized he was glad. She turned around to face him, so they were both lying on their sides, twin silhouettes in the darkness. The only thing that separated them was a shaft of moonlight slicing through the open window. Still, Watt waited. He refused to do this unless the first move came from her, no matter how crazy it was, no matter how crazy he was for wanting it. Lita lifted her chin and planted a kiss on his lips, tentative, feather light. Then she pulled back. "This still doesn't mean anything, okay?" she whispered. And even though he couldn't make out her expression, Watt could picture it, her brow furrowed in stubborn determination and fierce pride. "Of course. It means nothing," Watt agreed, knowing full well that they were trading lies.
Calliope. Calliope stood at the base of the tower's famous climbing wall, an enormous vertical structure that began on the 620th floor and spanned almost 30 floors upward, along the tower's north interior. She glanced at the clock that glowed constantly in the top left corner of her vision. She never turned it off, preferring to give a minimum of verbal commands to her contacts. There was nothing romantic about muttering "clock" during a flirtation. Almost 5 p.m., Calliope tried to resign herself to the fact that Atlas wasn't coming. When she'd casually flickered him this afternoon to let him know that she was climbing, she thought it was a brilliant plan. She remembered how much Atlas loved rock climbing, or at least, he used to. But she was starting to realize that New York Atlas had less in common with Tanzania Travis than she'd expected. She adjusted her aero harness and brushed her hands together before reaching for the first handhold, then the second. It might clear her head, climbing alone for a while.
"Starting without me, Callie?"
Calliope closed her eyes, allowing herself a brief, self-satisfied grin. She stayed clasped where she was on the wall, only a few meters above Atlas, arching her back just so as she looked down at him.
"I'm glad you made it," she called out.
Atlas smiled in that lopsided way of his, lifting only one corner of his mouth, as if he hadn't fully committed to the decision to smile. He stepped into an aero harness and lifted a strap over one broad shoulder.
"Sorry, it wasn't easy for me to escape work."
Calliope let go of the wall, and the aero harness caught her just a few centimeters into the fall, suspending her in midair. She pushed the soles of her shoes against the wall and spun lazily about, her black Artec pants showing off her long, lithe form.
"Your boss sounds unnecessarily strict, given that he's your dad," she pointed out.
Atlas gave an appreciative laugh. He yanked on a pair of gloves, fastening the second one with his teeth even though there was an auto-fasten setting.
"Piece of advice? Don't ever take a job for your mom. Because it really sucks working for a parent. You'd be surprised."
Calliope wondered what Atlas would say if he knew the deadly efficiency with which Calliope and Elise worked together. Atlas pushed a few buttons on a screen, setting his handholds to orange. Calliope's were already colored her signature bright fuchsia, and started up. She waited until he was close before spinning around to regain her handholds and join him. The wall was almost empty right now. There was a trio of climbers in the distance, but Calliope could barely hear them, let alone see them. It felt like she and Atlas were alone on some remote desert peak. The sun streamed in through the massive windows behind them.
There was something so soothing about climbing, Calliope thought as they crept beetle-like up the sheer, exposed face. Find handhold, find new foothold, pull yourself up, repeat. The motions were clean and uncomplicated, but they required focus, leaving no room for her mind to wander. She loved the rush of adrenaline in her stomach as she climbed ever higher, her body contracting a little in instinctive fear that she might fall, though of course the arrow harness wouldn't let that happen. Her shoulders began to ache with a pleasant soreness. She would definitely need to use a massage pillow in the hotel tonight. Next to her, Atlas was swinging wildly, like a creature let out of hell. He took huge, leaping jumps, missing hand and footholds, scrabbling desperately for purchase. More than once, Calliope saw him fall, only to be caught in midair. Then he would grit his teeth and start the furious climb again.
"You know that arrow harness is a safety device, not a toy. This isn't a race."
Her tone was deceptively lighthearted. What was Atlas so worked up about?
"You're only saying that because you're losing," Atlas called out from several meters above.
Calliope stifled a smile and tried to move faster, her foothold slightly less sure, her hands burning beneath the high-tech supergrip gloves. This high up, the rock face was covered in tiny ice crystals to simulate climbing Kilimanjaro or Everest. Against it, Calliope's pink handhold stood out as particularly ludicrous. She marveled at how the light turned the ice almost blue, little swirls of color sparking off it each time she brushed it. When she reached the summit, Atlas held out a hand to pull her up and over the top. She kept her palm in his for a moment, absorbing the unfamiliar but pleasant feel of it clasped around her own. When he let go, she felt a surprising pang of disappointment. The ceiling soared overhead, its solar panels a robin's egg blue, with little wisps of cloud darting across them. Despite the ice crystals, it was comfortably warm up here. Calliope plopped down on the gravelly surface and took a sip of water from her pack, her legs stretched out before her.
"So," Atlas asked, "what do you think of our man-made mountain?"
"A better climb than the one in the Singapore Tower, and definitely a better view than Rio," she replied, just to remind him how worldly and well-traveled she was. "But not as nice as the real thing. After all, it's not Africa."
Atlas was leaning back on his elbows, his heather-gray shirt damp with sweat. Expressions darted across his face too quickly for Calliope to make sense of them all. She wished she could snatch his thoughts from the air with her hands and take them to some lab to analyze. How did he really think of her? As a stranger, a travel buddy, a mistake, or as someone he wanted to get to know?
"He's just a mark," she chided herself.
It didn't matter what he thought of her, as long as she could figure out how to get something of value from him.
"No, it's not Africa," Atlas agreed, with a note of something like defeat. "But nothing ever is."
"Don't you want to go back?"
"Do you?"
Calliope hesitated. A month ago she would have said, "Maybe someday," the way she always spoke about the places she'd already been. The problem was simply that there were so many places in the world, so many corners she hadn't yet seen, and Calliope felt a deep, primal hunger to taste them all. Which was why she always spoke about the familiar with a touch of impatience. But there was something different about New York. Perhaps it was the energy that beat just below the surface, like a pulse or a drumbeat. Especially now, with the city suffused in a golden pre-holiday glow, there was a tangible magic in the air. Calliope found that lately she'd viewed the people she passed on her way to the lift, the people she normally pitied, whose lives seemed so routine and dull, with an uncharacteristic fondness. Like the girl who worked at the flower stand outside the Nuage, where Calliope always stopped to smell the freesia, or the wizened old man at Poilane Bakery, where she got a croissant almost every morning, because unlike other girls her age, she'd never bothered to count calories.
Even those wild-haired people who belted out songs on the lift had become strangely dear to her. New York called to something in Calliope's soul. She felt a kinship with the city, she thought, both of them dramatically remade from their previous incarnations, gleaming and exquisite and one of a kind. Against that, she weighed the siren song of all the new places she still had yet to explore, the adventures still lying in wait for her.
"I'm not sure," she admitted.
Atlas nodded. "Listen," he said after a beat. "I've been wanting to tell you. I'm sorry about last weekend."
"There's nothing to be sorry about," Calliope protested, attempting to sound flirtatious, though it came out a little high-strung. This afternoon wasn't playing out the way she'd hoped.
"Honestly, I was a mess that night. I guess I'm trying to give a blanket apology in case there's anything I do need to be sorry for," Atlas explained.
So he didn't remember anything. He'd been so drunk that he probably hadn't even intended to bring her home with him.
Calliope had been so proud of herself for finally getting somewhere with Atlas when it hadn't really meant anything at all. Still, there was one question she did want to ask while she and Atlas were companionable and easy in the afternoon light.
"Atlas, I'm curious. Why did you go to Africa?"
It was a question she'd never posed him in all their months together. And if he answered it honestly, it might offer her some insight into why he didn't seem to want her. He weighed her question carefully.
"I got myself in a bit of a mess," he said at last. "It's complicated. There were other people involved."
"Other people" sounded like a girl. That explained a lot.
"You act differently here,"
she said quietly, knowing it was a risk, but wanting to say it anyway.
"I miss the old you."
Atlas shot Calliope a curious glance, but he didn't seem angered by the remark.
"What about you? Why did you go to Tanzania?" he asked.
"Never ask a question that you yourself don't want to answer." That was another of Elise's cardinal rules. And Calliope knew she should have had a careful, flippant response ready. But for some reason, all she could think about was India. That family torn apart, and the old man on his deathbed, and Calliope standing there, a useless witness to it all, unable to do anything. She felt suddenly like the truth was beating on her skin like sweat, running in ugly rivulets down her body for Atlas to see.
"I had a bad breakup," Calliope said.
It was a lame excuse, but it was the best she could think of. They were quiet for a while. The sun fell ever lower in the artificial sky. Atlas's hand was right there on the ground next to her, drawing all of Calliope's awareness like a magnet. She wanted to feel it in hers again. Feeling reckless, she reached out and put her hand on top of his. He started at the movement, but didn't pull away. She took that as a good sign.
"When do you leave for Dubai?" she asked.
She needed to know how much time she had left on this con. It was a ticking clock.
"I'll probably stay full time after the party. At least that's what my dad wants."
Atlas didn't sound that excited. Calliope wondered if going to Dubai hadn't been his idea at all.
"Atlas, do you even want to go to Dubai?"
He lifted one shoulder in a shrug.
"Does anyone ever really know what they want? Do you?"
"Yes," Calliope said automatically. Atlas's eyes were sharp on hers.
"What?"
She opened her mouth to give another empty, flippant answer. Something like, "How could I want for anything? My life is perfect." But found that the words crumbled to ash in her mouth. She was tired of telling people exactly what she thought they needed to hear.
"To be loved," she said simply. They might have been the truest words she'd ever spoken aloud.
"You are loved."
Calliope let out a breath.
"By my mom, sure."
"And all your friends back home?"
Atlas said urgently. Calliope thought again of Dara, the only real friend she'd ever had, whom she'd left without even saying goodbye.
"I don't actually have that many friends," she confessed. I don't make friends easily, I guess."
"You have me."
Atlas flipped his palm over so that it was touching hers, their fingers interlaced. His hand felt very warm and steady. Calliope looked over at him, but Atlas was staring at the window, to where the sun was setting below the jagged horizon of rooftops and spires, a blaze of crimson and fire. "Friends," he'd said, "but friends that held hands." He felt her gaze and turned to her, his face lifting into a smile. It was good enough for now, Calliope thought, even if it didn't quite reach his eyes. Avery leaned against her heavy bedroom door, bracing herself for the walk down the hallway. Over the past week, that walk, 16 steps, she'd counted them the other day, had become its own distinct sort of agony. Here in her room, she was safe, but the moment she opened that door, she risked seeing Atlas. Losing someone you loved was harrowing enough already, Avery reflected, without the added cruelty of constantly running into that person. Part of her still refused to believe that this wasn't all some terrible dream, that she wouldn't wake up and everything would be normal again, Eris still alive and Atlas still hers, and Calliope Brown off in Africa where she belonged. She would have given anything to go back to that awful night, except this time she would keep the trap door to the roof firmly shut. But that wasn't the world she lived in, and Avery could ignore the real world for only so long. Slinging her red gym bag over one shoulder, she stepped out into the hallway, just as Atlas turned the corner from his room, headed the same direction, several boxes rolling along behind him. It seemed that Avery's body was suddenly frozen in nitro-cryo. She couldn't move a single cell, couldn't even breathe. "You're leaving," she said into the fractured silence. For some reason, she hadn't thought that Atlas would be leaving yet, at least not until next weekend's party. The sight of him standing in the entry hall, surrounded by all his things, his eyes shadowed, wearing the soft brown sweater she'd always loved, struck Avery with a terrible finality. This was really it, she thought dazedly. Atlas was leaving, and he hadn't even been planning to tell her goodbye.
"Actually, this is just stuff I'm sending ahead," Atlas explained, and the panic in her chest relaxed a little. "Dad let me pick out an apartment in the new tower. I wanted to have some of my things waiting for me, you know?"
His voice was stiff and mechanical. "That makes sense." She didn't know what else to say. When would it stop hurting, seeing Atlas? Maybe it never would. She would become like those amputees from before they could regrow body parts. Her relationship with Atlas like a ghost limb that she kept trying to use, even though it was no longer there. Whether it was tomorrow or a month from now, he was still ultimately leaving. Avery stood there looking at him, thinking of all the things they had been to each other. All the jokes they'd shared as children, the secrets exchanged, the way Atlas had been the cool older brother helping her navigate high school. And then, of course, all the secret kisses and whispered I love yous of the past year. Now here they were, with nothing left to say to each other.
"Sorry, I'm late to Aquaspin."
Avery hiked her bag higher up on her shoulder and moved to the elevator. The tension in the air was so thick she imagined she could see it, like water droplets hanging there, distorting her vision. When she finally got to the Aquaspin studio at altitude, she peeled off her clothes with an audible sigh of relief. Wearing her old one-piece from swim team, she quickly slid into the pool, which was full of freshly imported Himalayan salt water. It looked like an almost full class today, though there was still an empty bike in the corner of the front row. Avery waded through the waist-deep water toward it, then lifted the seat to fit her long legs. Her eyes were adjusting to the dimness of the studio, which was illuminated by nothing except the floating fairy lights that danced above the water's surface. Serene, spa-like music emanated from all the speakers, creating the feel that they were in a mermaid's cave. None of it could relax Avery today. She kept mentally replaying her conversation with Atlas, wishing she'd said something more to him than, "That makes sense." She almost wished that she'd screamed at him instead, or punched him. Anything to relieve the press of emotions roiling through her. It felt like her blood had turned to jet fuel and was bubbling hot near the surface of her skin, burning her from the inside. A gong sounded to indicate the start of class, and a hollow of a thin, tanned woman on a bike appeared on the opposite brick wall. A few of the surrounding men and women in class muttered to their contacts as they logged into the competition board. Avery had never done it before, but why not? "Pedal board," she said aloud. A silver icon labeled with her bike number immediately appeared on the wall next to the dozen other bikes, all of them moving in a holographic race to the finish line. The studio echoed with a deep electronic beat. Avery picked up speed, her legs sloshing the pedals as she pushed endlessly against the heavy resistance of the salt water. She tried to lose herself in the movement, to work so hard that she would cut off the oxygen to her damn brain, so that for at least a few blissful minutes she wouldn't torture herself with thoughts of Atlas. Sweat poured down her back. Calluses were forming on her hands where they gripped the handlebars. Avery realized that she was neck and neck for first place with someone on bike 18 in the back row. She didn't know who it was, and it wouldn't have mattered if she did. She just felt a sudden primal resolve to win. It was as if all the mistakes and problems in her life had crystallized into this single race, and if she didn't win, Avery was doomed to be this miserable forever. She raced as if the act of doing so could change things, as if happiness was right there ahead of her, and if she went fast enough, she might be able to catch it. She tasted salt, and wasn't sure whether it was the water, or her sweat, or maybe her tears. And then it was over, and she looked up, and almost cried from relief because she'd won. She'd beaten Bike 18, just barely. She slipped off her bike and ducked her head under the water, not caring that her hair would get crunchy from the salt. She felt a strange and bizarre urge to weep. "I'm a mess," she thought bleakly, and finally pushed herself out of the pool. "I had a feeling that was you. On Bike 7, Lita was standing at the slatted wooden bench that lined the room, hands on her narrow hips. "You were Bike 18? Of course it was Lita, Avery thought, somehow unsurprised. Lita nodded. They both stood there, immobile as statues, as the rest of the class streamed past into the golden light of the hallway. Neither of them seemed willing to make the first move. Lita wrapped a towel around her waist, tucking its corner into a makeshift sarong, and suddenly Avery registered the bright blue print along the edge of the towel. "That's from Maine," she heard herself say. Lita looked down and shrugged. "I guess it is." She traced the pattern for a moment before looking up at Avery, her eyes glinting in the dim light. "Remember that time we went hunting for colored sea glass because we thought we could give it to your grandmother? And that huge wave knocked me over. I ran in after you," Avery recalled. "Wearing your new white sundress," Lita exhaled a breath that was almost a laugh. "Your mom was so pissed." Avery nodded, torn between confusion and a mingled pang of gratefulness for the memory. She'd lost so many people in her life lately. Eris, Lita, now Atlas. Suddenly, all she wanted was for the cycle to end. "Any chance you want to get a smoothie?" Lita asked very quietly, as if reading her mind. The silence in the Aqua studio was suddenly deafening. Everyone had gone, leaving nothing but the quiet lapping of the saltwater pool, the intermittent flashing of the fairy lights. The hollow on the brick wall before them flickered out. "Can we make it tacos instead?" Avery's blood was still pounding from class, her face flushed with exertion. She realized that, for the first time in a week, She felt something other than howling grief. Or worse, that terrible, aching numbness. She wanted desperately to preserve this fragile sense of warmth before she clattered inevitably back to reality. Lita smiled in response.
Cantina?
Where else? Avery wasn't sure whether this was a good idea. She wasn't sure how to treat Lita anymore, given everything that had happened between them. Were they best friends, or enemies, or strangers? She slid her feet into her flower-printed sandals, determined to find out. Lita. Cantina was the same as always, slick and intimidating, its blazing white surfaces so pristine that Lita almost felt nervous to touch them. She remembered how wide-eyed she'd been the first time she came here, in eighth grade, with Avery and her parents. Everyone was so thin and expensively dressed that to Lita's 13-year-old mind, they'd all looked like models. Then again, some of them actually were. Now she and Avery walked up the bold white staircase with spiky blue agave plants lining each step and settled into a cozy two-person booth upstairs. They both showered and used the stylers at altitude before coming here, and now that they were no longer in the surreal quiet of the Aqua Studio, now that they looked like their normal, immaculate selves, Lita was questioning whether this was a good idea. Avery saved her by speaking first. "How are you, Lita?" she asked. And for some reason, the absurd formality of the question made Lita want to burst out laughing. All the countless hours they'd spent together at this very restaurant, and yet here they were, acting like a couple on the worst first date of all time. Suddenly, she knew exactly what to say. "I'm sorry," she began, the words coming out awkwardly. She'd never been very good at apologies. "For everything I did and said that night on the roof. You know I didn't mean for it to happen." No need to clarify what it was. They both knew. "I swear, it was an accident. I would never..." "I know," Avery said tersely, her hands clenching just a little under the table. "But you didn't need to act all wild and threatening about it afterward, Lita. It would have been all right if you'd come forward and told the truth." Lita stared at her blankly. Sometimes it shocked her how delusional Avery was. Sure, if it had been Avery Fuller who pushed Eris off the tower, no one would give her more than a slap on the wrist. But Lita's family was nowhere near as powerful or established as the Fullers, even though they did have money now. If Lita came forward, there would have been an investigation, probably even a trial. And Lita knew how the evidence looked. A jury would have very happily convicted Lita for manslaughter, unlike Avery, who was inherently unpunishable. No one would ever even consider sending her to prison. She was simply too beautiful for it. "Maybe," she said cautiously, hoping that would be enough. "I'm sorry for that too, though. I'm sorry for everything I said that night." Avery nodded, slowly, but didn't answer. Lita swallowed. "Eris did some stuff that really hurt me. Some seriously messed up stuff. I didn't even want to talk to her, but she kept coming at me, even though I told her to back off. But still, I never meant..." "What did Eris do?" Avery asked. Lita nervously tucked her hair behind her ears. "She was sleeping with my dad," she whispered. "What? I know, it sounds crazy, but I saw them together. I saw them kissing." Lita's voice pitched wildly. She was so desperate to be believed. She took a deep breath and began the whole sordid story. How her dad had been acting funny, as if he was hiding something. The Calvador scarf that Lita had found, which she then saw her dad give to Eris. How he'd lied and said he was at a client dinner, but instead she'd found him at dinner with Eris, holding hands and kissing across the table. Avery was silent with shock.
"Are you sure?"
she asked finally.
"I know. I didn't want to believe it of Eris either, let alone my dad."
Lita couldn't even look at Avery's face right now. Couldn't face the shock, the disgust that was surely written there, or she might burst into tears. She busied herself, tapping on the surface of the table to place their order.
Medium or spicy guacamole?
Spicy, plus queso, Avery added.
God, Lita. I'm so sorry.
Does your mom know?
Lita shook her head. I never told her.
Avery, of all people, would understand how painful it had been, keeping something that big from her family. How Lita had felt stretched thin by the secret, which pressed slowly and inexorably down on her, never relenting even for a minute.
I'm sorry. That's terrible.
Avery traced a circle on the pristine table. She didn't seem able to make eye contact either.
How can I help?
She asked finally, looking up. Her eyes were brimming with tears. Typical Avery, thinking she could take on all the problems of the world.
You can't solve everything, you know, Lita said, as a hover tray whirled over to deposit the guacamole on their table.
It was chunky and fresh, made with real avocados, not the infused algae protein cubes that they mashed up in Mid-Tower and called guacamole.
I know. That was always your job.
Avery wiped at her eyes and sighed.
God, I wish we'd never fought in the first place.
Me neither, Lita agreed. Atlas wasn't worth it. I mean, not to me, he wasn't. She fumbled to explain. Across the table, Avery's eyes were very blue and very serious. I never loved him. I realize that now. Lita went on, bravely. She knew this wasn't what Avery wanted to talk about, that it would be safer to avoid it altogether. But talking was the only way to make things right. Lita imagined her words spanning the space between her and Avery, like the Ethereum bridges that built themselves molecule by painstaking molecule.
I thought I loved him, but it was just infatuation. I loved the idea of him. Or maybe I should say that I wanted to love him, but I never succeeded in it.
That night in the Andes felt so long ago now, when Lita thought she'd fallen hopelessly for Atlas. But all it had really been was hormones and excitement. Like what you feel for Watt? A voice in her whispered. A voice she tried desperately to silence. She hadn't told anyone that she and Watt were hooking up. God, she and Watt didn't even speak about it. But in the few days since they'd come back from Nevada, he'd come over to her place every night. She never even asked him. He just showed up the first evening, and she let him wordlessly in the back door, and then they collapsed together onto her bed in a tangle of silent, crushing need. Still, Lita hadn't let Watt get too far. She'd learned that lesson the hard way. She kept holding something back, out of self-preservation. Because she was developing feelings for him, and that was the one outcome she had never expected. Next to Watt, what she'd felt for Atlas felt long ago and childish. She realized that she no longer even cared whether Avery dated him. Hell, why not? It wasn't any more fucked up than anything else in this crazy, fucked up world.
You love him, though, don't you?
She asked, already knowing the answer.
Yes,
Avery said, with more pause than Lita had expected. She let out a great breath.
But he's really hurt me.
By hooking up with me? Lita demanded, and immediately winced at the baldness of her words.
That was so long ago. It's ancient history, she added, more tactfully.
Avery seemed almost not to have registered her outburst.
No, it's not that. He's been with someone else, more recently.
Her eyes flicked downward.
I'm pretty sure we're over. For good. You don't mean that girl from the gala, with the tacky dress and the British accent? What was her name, Catastrophe?
Calliope, Avery corrected with a ghost of a smile. They met while Atlas was traveling in Africa. She and her mom just moved here.
Really?
She met Atlas halfway across the world, and now she's in New York. How awfully convenient. Lita's instincts pricked to life.